Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and today we'll take a look at some of the bugs that are infiltrating your garden, and we'll take a look at how fruit and vegetable crops are doing so far with our guest, Scott Royce, with us from our Green Bay studios today. He's the UW Extension Crop Soils and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto and Florence counties. So he's ready to answer your questions, and I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And before we get going, I want to say a big thanks to the gang in Minocqua and the Science on Tap alumni group for inviting me to speak Wednesday night, this past Wednesday night. I had a blast, a lot of fun, and I hope they did as well. Hope I get asked back sometime. Scott Royce, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Glad to be able to be here.
You know, we hear a lot about Japanese beetles. We talk about them a lot. Rose chafers come up a lot, not as much. What does a rose chafer look like?
Well, they're kind of the meek second cousin of Japanese beetle, but they're the native type. That's the good thing about them, is that rose chafers are actually native. They're a beetle. They have the way I describe them as far as coloration is that they're kind of a tannish green, if you can combine those two colors into one beetle that's about a half an inch long, about a quarter of an inch wide as far as their main body. But they've got a pretty leggy appearance. They have orangish legs usually, so their legs are a little bit longer and wider than their body, but certainly not as robust as the Japanese beetles, which are pretty stout, you know, really metallic, shiny beetles. But the rose chafers, the other big difference between the rose chafers and the Japanese beetles, and the reason that those of us further north are glad that we don't have Japanese beetles quite as badly yet as most of the rest of the southern part of the state, is that the Japanese beetle adults live for about 2 months, and the rose chafers, being a native, only survive as adults for about 10 to 14 days. So we don't have to deal with quite as much of a damage time frame as people who are experiencing Japanese beetles do.
Well, given the name, I expect the roses are among the plants that the chafer prefers. Is that true? What other plants?
Yeah, that entire Rosaceae family is really their focus, but they do feed on a whole litany of things. And quite honestly, I think maybe use rose as a signal of the plant part that they're going to go after more so than the species, because they really like flowers. You know, flower petals are pretty easy to digest. They have a little bit higher content of digestibility as far as nutrients and sugars go, so they really focus on them. So anything that's in bloom when those adults are out are generally going to get hammered. And for us up in my neck of the woods, we usually think of peonies first. When the peonies are blooming is when the rose chafers are usually out, and they love peony flowers, especially white ones.
Oh, man. So they can do a fair amount of damage.
Yeah, they really take off. Unfortunately, they take off the part that people are growing the plants for. Is they really go after the flowers. So, but again, species wise, peonies, roses, they'll feed on petunias. They'll feed on a litany of different floral plants. But in the fruit world, they can also cause a really severe set of damage pretty fast too. Mostly focusing on grapes, raspberries, and apple.
And what about control? What can we do to control them?
Well, I facetiously say move about 1,000 miles north to a lot of people, but unfortunately, because they are a native insect and they lay their eggs in sparsely vegetated areas. They don't lay their eggs in lawn turf like Japanese beetles or the European chafers do. So we can't really do any grub control that is effective against rose chafers. We have to really just focus on preventing the adults. And that's not easy or fun because they're coming after blooming plants usually. So if we use any insecticides, we're going to take out pollinators. So we have to be really careful and really think about, okay, can we live with the damage for 10 to 14 days? Can we just go around and handpick them, you know, take a coffee can, coffee grounds can around with some soapy water in it and just shake the flowers off and they'll fall into there and drown? Or can we, maybe if we have a really high value rose, for example, in our landscape, maybe we should consider using insect netting rather than trying to use an insecticide. On fruits, we have one valid non-insecticidal option, and that's a product called Surround. It's actually a kaolin clay product where you literally, you're whitewashing your plants. So they look weird for those 2 weeks or so that the rose chafers are out, but it leaves a gritty residue on the leaf and the young fruit, so they don't like feeding on it, so they go elsewhere.
We have callers online, many callers, as a matter of fact. Let's go to Green Bay and talk to Andrea. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I have a question about flea beetles. So we have an organic garden and put in arugula as seedlings. And, boy, right away, overnight, the flea beetles were on it. So how do you prevent flea beetles right from the get-go?
Well, it goes back to something I just mentioned with rose chafers. If you are in an organic situation, really for flea beetles, one of the only effective ways is actually using some type of a netting, you know, a Remay type product, but, you know, some type of an insect netting, especially with something like arugula, because it can handle some shade and still do full, still get to full size and full production capacity. So that would definitely be one of the only good options in reality for your exact situation. In general, if something like flea beetles, which are a fast moving, adult beetle, but they're not very big. Because they're so mobile, there aren't too many insecticidal options that are either going to be labeled for use in a vegetable situation or that are actually going to be very effective. So it probably goes to insect netting first, or if they're going to be showing up on transplants and you are willing to use some insecticides, they're probably anything that would be labeled for whatever plant you are, or plant or group of plants that you are working with, would probably be effective.
There you go. Thanks, Andrea, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Lisa in Lisbon next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show. I love it. And I'm calling regarding wild ones, which I know, Larry, you've mentioned periodically, and thank you for that support.
Sure.
I'm the chapter president of the Menominee River Area Chapter, and just wanted to remind members and the general public this month is Native Plant Appreciation Month at Johnson's Nursery, and it's our annual native plant sale. All members of Wild Ones will receive 40% off of their purchase, and there will be Wild One members available Saturday mornings to help to chat with, to sign up new members, and we hope that we can really get some interest going, additional interest rolling in native plant landscaping. So I thank you for letting me have a couple of minutes on your show.
And Lisa, where again do we can we go?
It's Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls on Marcy Road. And the plant sale takes place there. And every Saturday morning till about noon, we will have Wild Ones members there, but people can shop all through the month of June during their regular hours.
Lisa, thank you very much for calling. Scott, I imagine you have some folks who are members of Wild Ones in your area.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the Green Bay area, and a few members from further north that are certainly and pretty heavily involved. That kind of brings up the concept of working with invasive plants, because most of our really nasty invasive plant species are in full glory right now. In this particular area, the Dames Rocket is, it's gorgeous. That's why it gets spread, is because people purposely plant it. But Dames Rocket is a lot of well, people tend to call it phlox. They mistake it for phlox, but it's actually a four-petaled version of a very invasive annual mustard, perennial mustard, but very pretty all the way from white to really deep purple, but a pretty good-sized plant, you know, 3 to 4 feet tall. Forms pretty dense stands, however, and can kind of take over an area. So that's one that's in full bloom now. Garlic mustard is coming off of full bloom and is setting pods. I was actually pulling that because I've got a small stand of that at our place. If you have invasive species on your property, now is the time to make sure that they're not successfully setting seed, because that's one of the only ways we can win those battles against invasive plants is to prevent them from spreading further.
And thanks again, Lisa, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joy in West Bend next.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not asking a question about bugs, but about weeds. We have an asparagus bed. Well, we had an asparagus bed full of weeds, so I started another one, and now it's full of quack grass. My husband likes to handle it by covering with, cardboard and other mulch. And that, I would guess, if you're covering up an area where you have asparagus planted, then it can't spread very easily. He covers everything except where the spears are, and I would like to know if there's another way to manage the quack grass without covering it, and it needs to be organic.
Okay. Certainly weed control in an asparagus patch is one of the biggest problems we have with asparagus, that and probably the asparagus beetles. There's two asparagus beetle species that cause plenty of problems for them too. But weed management is always difficult in a perennial vegetable setting like that because we have few pesticidal options as far as the herbicides. You know, really, it's if you are willing to use them, it really comes down to using a glyphosate product early in the year, or if you are a certified pesticide applicator, then you have some other opportunities. But in most home vegetable situations, of course, we're not going to want to go that route. So we have to look at physical control, and physical control revolves around tillage, with whether it be a hoe or pulling them out, or actually using a shallow tiller right early season and getting stuff out before the asparagus gets started in the year. But then also one really good thing that you could try doing is to maintain a weed-free barrier around the patch. And when you have things like turf grass and quack grass, which really spread in from the sides with their rhizomes more than anything else, if we can prevent them from getting in by having that weed-free zone, you know, of 12 to 24 to 36 inches, depending on the size of your patch, around the perimeter, you can make yourself or your life a lot easier within that patch. So that would be one thing. Mulching, whether it be with cardboard or whether it be with something else, you know, lawn clippings, straw, hay products, whatever you may want to use during the rest of the growing season is probably the other really valid and good approach. Now, the cardboard part, you know, you're asking specifically, is there an alternative to that? And yeah, but cardboard is certainly a valid option too, because once those spears are up, you know, generally, or once they are up and in their fern growth stage, you know, where they're branching out and flowering and setting seeds, they aren't going to have too many more buds that get released and new spears coming up. So it's not a horrible approach for later in the growing season, but during the earlier part of the growing season, I'd probably lean toward a looser mulch that the spears can actually get through yet. So again, something that hay, straw, that kind of category.
And if you're starting a new patch, the varieties and the type that you choose can also be helpful, I think. The male varieties, for example.
Well, yeah, there's a little bit of difference in their strength. The all-male types are actually a little bit smaller spears than what the female spears would be, but they are much more consistent. That's really the selling point of those all-male cultivars. Realistically speaking, the management of the patch is going to be very similar, whatever type of you have, whether it's the old-style it's either Mary or Martha Washington. I don't remember which. And then that's one of the oldest cultivars known of asparagus, you know, or some of the new ones, you know, the Jersey Night series, or, you know, all those types as well. But really, the management is very critical. We need to get those weeds taken care of early before the asparagus gets started, because what the asparagus is doing now, from the, you know, kind of we're toward the end of the harvest season for most people. A lot of people will still harvest for another week or two here yet. But from the end of the harvest season through the rest of the growing season is what sets up our asparagus patch for next year's production. And, you know, so giving them some, especially some extra nitrogen, probably a little bit earlier than now, but you could still get away with a little bit yet now. And keeping that weed control, or having good weed control, I need to say that correctly, so that you don't have as much competition, and then get as much strength into those crowns for next year's bud production. That way you'll have better production next year.
Makes very good sense. Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Crop, Soils, and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Ocano, and Florence counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Scott Royce, UW Extension Crop, Soils, and Horticulture Agent. Always fun to have him with us. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Jan in Viroqua up next with a question.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Scott. I have a beautiful old grapevine that came with the house that I moved into 2 years ago. And both seasons prior to this, it has taken care of itself and born abundantly and looked very happy. This year is having a really tough time. It leafed out so late I was afraid that I'd pruned it wrong. When it did leaf out, some of the leaves looked damaged, and then now it's getting lacy leaves, and they're little black worm-like creatures about a third of an inch long, about the size less than the diameter of a pencil lead, crawling around on it, eating it. And I would love an organic solution, and any suggestions you have.
Okay. There's a few different possibilities as far as what the insect itself may be in this situation. There are a number of different sawfly species that will feed on grapes, so it's possible it's one of the sawflies that feed on them. I'm running through the empty space in my mind trying to find the
sawflies are a good possibility though.
Yeah, they're certainly one of the possibilities. I mean, there are so many different things that will feed on grapes. So realistically, you know, as you were starting to set up the question, I was starting to think, okay, rose chafers, Japanese beetles aren't probably out yet, but you know, okay, because there are so many different things that will feed on grapes. And then last year with all the moisture, diseases were really our biggest problem with grapes last year, not so much the insects. But anyway, as far as getting to the real point of the question was, what do I do for control on something like this? And one of the advantages we have with soft, small-bodied insect, or soft, small-bodied, small, soft-bodied, let me say that right, insects, are that we do have some more control options, because they're just simply easier to kill, being blunt. You know, so we have things like insecticidal soap solutions, which are not pesticides from the standpoint where they are toxins now, because they actually smother the insect. They basically form a bubble around them, and they don't allow oxygen to get in through their exoskeleton. So insecticidal soap solutions, do make sure though that you actually buy an insecticidal soap product that is properly labeled. It is not legal or recommended in any way, shape, or form to use like Dawn dish soap, which is one of the most common household remedies you'll find on the web. It's not legal and it's not recommended because it doesn't work as well, and you will find plants that it will have negative reactions. So, but anyway, insecticidal soap solutions, are one of the better ways. Again, I mentioned that Surround product. Surround does work pretty well on grapes. So that would be another possibility, but for the types of insect you're dealing with, it might not work quite as well as the insecticidal soap solution. So those are two of the better options probably that are non-toxic.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And we have, who's next? Joe in Green Bay up next. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
I have quite an issue with jewel weed in my backyard. It's so invasive, and I spend hours every week pulling it as it grows. I'm wondering what I can do to eradicate it and totally get rid of it, if that's possible.
Well, it's going to take time, patience, and work, I guess, is the unfortunate trio of... there's definitely not a magic bullet that goes with that species or most of our invasive-type plants. So a combination of continuing to pull it out, getting plants that you want to grow in there and getting them to be healthy so that they can outcompete, in your case, the jewelweed or in other, you know, whatever other invasive species that someone might be working with. There are opportunities to do some herbicidal treatments if you have really dense populations of an invasive species. But you have to be cautious on how you're using them, that you're using them at the proper time, and being able to target that application so that you really hammer the species you're trying to kill and not cause more problems for the species that you want to be proliferating in that spot. So unfortunately, I can't give you an absolute easy answer to your question because it is going to take, in the case of species such as this, it's usually going to take a few years. You know, I mentioned I was pulling some garlic mustard last night. Garlic mustard is a little bit different in that it only spreads from seed, but it's the same concept where it takes years of work if you are actually going to eradicate it. And if you give up on it for a year, it'll spread that much more or come back because you missed those two little plants over in the corner or something like that.
And I should mention, as long as weeds came up, next week, Wednesday, we have a show on invasive plants.
Okay.
And so some folks from the DNR and UW Extension will be along to talk about that. So just to mention that. Joe, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Rudy in Pewaukee has something for us. Hi, Rudy.
Well, hi. How are you doing, Larry?
Good.
Hey, I've got a question. We've got an area of our property that has a lot of weeds, and I've been pulling and I've been using glycophosphate over the years, and there must be a ton of seeds in the soil. So anyway, last night I used glycophosphate and I sprayed the entire field with it, and I'm thinking when they die, instead of trying to pull them, I'm just going to burn them to the ground. And I'm wondering, is that going to leave any seeds that are still viable?
Okay, well, this kind of hits me dead center in my wheelhouse as far as the introduction to your question, because I was my master's degree is actually in weed seed bank biology and weed management. So believe it or not, the average square foot of garden and landscape area has between 7,500 and 10,000 viable seeds. Per square foot, okay? So now, multiply that by 43,560 and you get how many are in an acre. Okay, so yeah, we're talking about millions of seeds in large areas. So yes, that viable seed bank is there. There are certain species of weeds and native species as well that can live for decades in the soil as dormant viable seed. So, yes, weed management is a process. It is not a one-stop shop. Okay, now getting to your direct question regarding the concept of what's the best way of managing weeds in particular areas, again, there is not a single perfectly correct answer because it does depend a lot on what species of weeds you are dealing with. The perennials such as quackgrass, bromegrass, some of the perennial thistles, those types of things. Glyphosate is certainly a valid option as a broader spectrum and broader size area control. What you do after the plants are dead is a little bit less important, quite honestly. Proper application and proper application timing is actually more important if you are using a systemic herbicide such as glyphosate. The post-spray, the more tillage you do, the more seeds you bring up. So burning, if you don't do tillage, then your question about burning, it can help reduce weed seed populations, but it certainly isn't going to completely eliminate them. And obviously, burning is a little bit different set of risk management tools, and make sure that for your municipality that you're meeting any laws that may have to be done, and getting your burn permit and all that kind of stuff. Whether you choose to burn, whether you choose to just leave that material dormant and then plant in between there, again, it really is going to be dictated by precisely what types of plants you're going to be putting in there, what types of weed species you are dealing with in the first place, and a few other factors.
There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Linda in Suamico.
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
We have a fairly new asparagus plot. Maybe this is like the second year. My husband's done a really good job of keeping the weeds down. We put it in a raised garden bed. But this spring, we noticed, I was out there the other day, and there are little tiny black worms on the fronds. I've never seen anything like this. I'm familiar with asparagus beetles, and my husband thought maybe that was the eggs laid by the asparagus beetles, but I don't see any asparagus beetles, period. And just these tiny little black worms, and they're eating the fronds. A lot of it has turned already. It is dead. And so I don't know if we'll be able to salvage them. I mean, the plants themselves are about 2-3 feet high, and we were just letting them seed, but I don't know if they'll seed now because of it. What is that, and how do I take care of it?
Well, you're between the two of you. You are correct. That is actually the grub of the asparagus beetles. If from what you've described, you're spot on with what I would expect to see at this time of the year for them. And you may or may not have seen the actual asparagus beetles because they don't stay on the plants a long time sometimes. So they do lay their eggs. Their eggs are usually 90-degree projections off of the stalks of asparagus, small little black, hair-like structures. And then when they hatch, the grubs start feeding on the stalk, on the frond branches, and then eventually a lot of times they'll end up feeding inside those seed capsules that form if the flowers do successfully set a seed capsule. On larger fronds, they really don't do as much damage, but if on a newer patch, certainly it bears concern. You could go around and on a smaller patch, like it sounds like you have, because you talked about it being in a raised bed. Quite honestly, I would lean toward hand control and I realize it's not fun and it does take a little bit of time, but just literally go around and pick them off, squish them, or put them in a can, or feed them to chickens if you have any, or whatever makes sense for you. Just try to make sure that you don't let any new populations go, but the adult beetles should be done for the year by now. Otherwise, there are a litany of insecticidal options. Because they are still small grubs, you could actually use one of the BT products that are formulated for beetle control. Make sure that you get a BT for beetle or coleopteran control rather than some of the other types, because the BT products are very specific in what they will actually control.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob emailed to say something's ailing his raspberries. It showed up last year, seems to be back, starts with withered leaves at the top of the cane. Eventually, the whole cane is affected. Wondering what's going on here and what he could do.
Okay, possibility there is the raspberry cane borer, which is actually, it is a sawfly species. But if the cane developed properly, got to a certain size, and then you kind of get a wilting or dying portion on the top, that's usually the raspberry cane borer. And what they do is the female actually uses her ovipositor and makes two rings of holes around the cane, entirely around the cane, usually about 6 to 10 inches from the top of the cane. And then in between the two rings of holes, she lays one egg. And then that, if that egg hatches, the grub starts burrowing down through the cane. And if it is successful, it will kill that entire cane. It usually doesn't go into the crown and kill the crown, but it will kill that entire cane. So the easiest way to control them is, and this is a very common, this is statewide, it's very common. Pretty much everywhere where we grow raspberries, you're going to see some of these. But they usually don't cause, you know, or they usually aren't in high enough populations that they'll cause problems for an entire patch. But after you start seeing those dead tips, just go around and hand prune those areas, find those rings of little holes and prune underneath there. And if you find a hollow stem, keep going down because you haven't caught up to the grub yet.
There we go. Mike in Kewaunee County emailed to say he has a half dozen maples that were hit by what he thinks are sugar maple borers, black with distinctive yellow markings, and wondering what he could do.
I have to admit I'm not familiar with that insect species, if he's fairly sure about that. So that might be one he may need to do some follow-up with his local extension office. If he's in Sheboygan, he can get in contact with the Sheboygan County Extension Office and either Mike Ballwig, who's the agriculture agent there, or one of the master gardeners there, because I don't want to say something that's completely and utterly wrong, because that's not a species I'm familiar with. There's a whole litany of insects that affect sugar maples. At this time of the year, one of the ones we usually start getting questions about is the maple petiole borer, which causes the leaf blade to fall off of the trees. But it's just a hair early for them, but although it might be the start of the season down there.
Jim in Cambridge, we turn to you next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you, and good morning. My wife and I own about 7 acres of land on Lake Ripley. About half of it is wetlands. The other half is woods. And we'd love to kind of add some walking paths in the woods. And so far, what I've been doing is just using a lawnmower or spring trimmer to kind of cut the paths, but I'm wondering if your guest has any advice on how to kind of make it a little bit more permanent, a way to kind of knock down the ground cover without harming any of the trees.
A little bit of a tricky situation, certainly, because anytime we add material or add management activities into a natural setting like that, we are certainly changing what's going to be happening, you know, because we're creating more edge effect by mowing or by putting a mulch pathway down or anything else that we would do. So we're creating edge effect that changes the biological dynamics within the soil a little bit, and certainly within the communities of plants that are growing right in those spots. So realistically speaking, what you're doing is probably as low impact as anything else, other than maybe trying to find natural zones through your property where you can really minimize that, where they're already heavily shaded and you're just able to essentially manage any plants that would be coming up with just with your foot traffic. But otherwise, yeah, it would. The only real valid options are mulching with a natural product, whether it be wood chips or bark chips or something like that, in those problem areas, so that you don't have to do as much plant management. But then in the areas where you really don't have as much stuff coming up, I would lean toward leaving them as just the mulch. The leaf mulch that is falling naturally.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks, Jim, for calling. And Jill in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. This is the second year in Wood County we've had the lily leaf beetle. And the only information you get from the UW learning store or other places is dated 2014, and they just talk about using an insecticide soap or neem oil. So my friend used neem oil on her tiger lilies, and it killed them. And I've used insecticide soap, spraying them, and it doesn't work. And I know you're supposed to take the beetle off, and of course it's red and with a black bottom, and it flips over and it lands on the ground, and it keeps its eggs in the ground. My question is, if I took strips of newspaper and used a non-Dawn soap and soaked it on there and laid it on the ground between the plants, would that help?
Well, I'm not going to plead ignorance. I know a little bit about this beetle, but thankfully we don't have to deal with it in too many areas in the state yet. You happen to be one of the lucky areas, or one of the few lucky areas. But it certainly is a very problematic insect if you do raise anything in the Lilium family. It's very, very destructive. It's a very damaging insect. But as far as control methodology, I'm hesitant to believe that the methodology you talked about is really going to do much good. I realize and understand your frustration in trying to deal with the adult insects, because those beetles are very good at escaping in various ways. But that's going to probably be the most effective long term. Certainly, there are a number of insecticides that are labeled for use on an ornamental species such as Lilium, because we're not dealing with edible portions of plants, although, technically they're edible flowers, but not too many people eat them. So you've got a wide array of options if you get frustrated enough to deal with them that way. The neem oil is a little bit of a combination of repellent and having some insecticidal opportunity, but I wouldn't think that neem oil would really do much against the adult beetles. So I think that would be more of a repellent situation there. And insecticidal soap has zero activity against adult beetles. It cannot really do anything at all. It only works on soft-bodied insects. So there, again, it's going to be patience and persistence and trying some different things. If you'd be willing to follow up, you can find my email on Marinette County webpage, and I can try to follow up with more detailed information, because that's one that I don't know the full biology of that particular insect well enough to maybe have all of the options in my head.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I wanted to go back for just a second, too. You were talking, kind of cautioning one of our callers about burning and watching out for controlled burns and so forth. I was in Saskatchewan a few weeks back, and they had a controlled burn there, and it got out of hand and burned 50,000 acres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why in the state of Wisconsin, you can't do controlled burns of more than an acre of area with technically without having DNR personnel present or local fire personnel. So that's actually right in the permitting process usually. So burning is effective in the right situations, but it is certainly a big risk.
Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Crops, Soils, and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about all kinds of pests today, and I'm getting some other gardening questions as well with our guest, Scott Royce, UW Extension Crops, Soils, and Horticulture Agent. Great to have him along, and thank you for listening. An open line at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to John next in Dunn. John, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. I have a problem because I'm getting what's called Virginia creeper creeping into my garden areas, and I'm allergic to the stuff, and it's, I don't know if anybody... You got any experience with that? How to get rid of that stuff?
What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, that one actually isn't Well, it is a native plant, so let's start there. So technically, it's not an invasive species. Certainly, it spreads well, but it's not legally an invasive species. Virginia creeper is one where, again, it takes time and patience to get rid of it completely, but it is a little bit more manageable than some of the other species we've been talking about earlier here today. Virginia creeper has the unique, well, not completely unique, but it has the ability to fit whatever space it is given. In other words, if it's growing in a lawn, it'll stay right on the low, you know, it doesn't do well in a lawn, but in a, you know, if it's growing in a grass area, it'll stay on the ground and form essentially a horizontal vining, you know, because it is a vining plant. It'll just stay along the ground. If it is growing around trees or shrubs, it'll go up those trees or shrubs. So the trick is finding the base of the plant, you know, doing what, and I realize, obviously, if you're allergic to it, you're going to have to wear proper clothing and make darn sure you wear good gloves, you know, preferably some neoprene or something like that gloves, so you don't get the plant on you and cause allergic reactions. But pull what you can, because that's the starting point. We were talking earlier about seed banks, so prevent that plant from setting seed, those berries, and then getting spread by birds and such. So do that as best you can. But then if you find the main part of the plant, you could consider doing what we call a cut stump treatment, where, and even though it's not much of a stump per se, but it's still technically a stump, you just cut that off with a pruners and then immediately paint the surface with one of the brush killer formulations, you know, or just a full strength glyphosate product. That's one way to try to get rid of the main crown of the plant, and particularly if it's in a situation where it's more vertical. Now, you say it's getting into your garden, and I understand that. I fight it too at our place. So you do have to do a little bit more work there, because it's going to have more of a lateral root system along with the main crown. So you have to do a little bit more physical work to get the entire plant out of the area.
John, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for this program. What's on my mind is my wife and I have a little prairie that we started a couple of years ago, and I also have a garden next to it. But we're not concerned about our lawn all that much. But I was wondering, is there an easy way to identify more common weeds that get into our prairie that we should root out, because we're not really familiar what prairie plants we have all the time, because we got them from friends but we do have some grasses in there, but like jewelweed, for example, somebody mentioned that's that real sticky stuff, right? What does Virginia creeper look like? Somebody mentioned that. Is there a resource I can go to see photographs or something of the more common invasives?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure.
Certainly, there's a number of different possibilities available both in print and on the web. You know, some of the web-based products are pretty easy to use now. The Wisconsin DNR has a very exhaustive invasive plants webpage that goes through and has photos. It's a little bit trickier to wade through if you really don't have a good starting point and don't have too much information on it. There is another place that on the web that can help you identify weeds, and that's weedid.wisc.edu, I think, is the webpage. I know it's weedid, so weedid is right in the address, or if you go Wisconsin Weed ID into a search engine, it'll probably take you right there. The trick with that web page is that it's designed to help people identify weeds. So the front page looks a little bit onerous if you've never used it before, because it has all kinds of questions. The trick with that website is don't answer a question unless you know for sure what the answer is. Because if you answer a question incorrectly, it's going to kick out some of the possibilities. So just answer the things that you absolutely know. So like in this situation, it's in a prairie setting. It's a broadleaf plant. It has opposite or alternate leaves or whatever. Or if you know what the flower color is, okay? But only put in the stuff you know and then click submit or whatever the button says on there. And then it'll give you all the possibilities that fit your description. And then you can look through the pictures and say, oh, hey, here we are. And if nothing else, you can probably at least get the family of weed identification that way. And of course, obviously, you've got the opportunity to take samples in or take good digital photos of the specimen and get them to local extension personnel, and we can help you go through stuff as well.
Here we go. We have Betty next in Wauwatosa. Hi, Betty.
Hi there.
What can
Thank
we do you for you?
Taking my call.
Yeah.
I have always enjoyed my phlox plants. They're faithful as can be, and they add a lot of beautiful color to the yard. However, this year I have some concerns because it seems as though they have some type of a disease where the tip of the plant like withers. Just like a couple inches on top is all that the only problem that I've had so far. But it has spread. I must have about 8 or 10 clumps of phlox throughout the flower beds, and it's hit each and every one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a friend of mine said that she lost her phlox with something like this.
Yeah.
That's how it started, and before long the whole plant was gone.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, okay, I'm going to set this up just a hair quick. Certainly, anytime we're dealing with a perennial flowering species such as phlox, there are always opportunities for serious, truly deadly problems such as, root rots, crown rots, etc. Phlox is particularly known for being susceptible to powdery mildew and a number of other fungal diseases. That said, I'm going to put, if I were a betting person, now that sports gambling is legalized in the U.S., I suppose I can say this on the air. But anyway, I would put money on the fact that what you are dealing with is actually spider mite infestations. Phlox are notorious and horribly affected by early season spider mite infestations. I know my wife and I are dealing with this in ours. We actually had to do some extra control measures for the spider mites this year in particular. So phlox get really heavily infested by spider mites. They can make the plant look like they are dying, and they can be that severe, especially if you are in a dry pattern or your phlox does not get direct moisture very easily from rainfall. So that's going to be my bet based on what you've said to this point in describing the issue. If that is the case, you should be able to flip the leaves over because spider mites feed on the underside of the leaf. And if they're really bad, you'll actually see really thin webbing between the leaf blade and the petiole and the stem and such like that. But normally, you're just going to have to flip the leaf over, look on the bottom surface of the leaf, and if you have good eyesight, because they're little, you'll actually be able to see the spider mites, or you can use a little hand lens or something like that. If spider mites are the issue, quite honestly, if it's a small enough plant, just washing them off with a good water spray. But again, think of where they are. They're on the bottom of the leaf, so you have to spray from the bottom up. So it gets messy.
Yeah, for sure.
Otherwise, use an insecticide that has spider mites on the label, because not all insecticides work against spider mites, or this is a great example of a spot where insecticidal soap can work pretty well. But again, you got to have good coverage, so you got to spray from the bottom up. That's not easy with an insecticidal soap solution.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Jean in Sauk County emailed to ask what size hole and type of fabric netting should she use and put over her raspberries to stop Japanese beetles. She'd like to reuse, and she's concerned about tears and thorns.
Yeah, that's going to be tricky on raspberries because you're going to have to protect such a large area. You may need to actually put up a structure and, you know, PVC tubing, such like that, over the top of the raspberries, and then put your insect netting product, whatever you decide to use. You know, it has basically you could go up to about, what I suppose, up to about an eighth of an inch netting squares or smaller to keep Japanese beetles out. You know, if you want to go the whole nine yards, so to speak, and keep spotted winged Drosophila and everything else out right away, then you need to go with a lot finer insect netting. Because of the concerns the caller brought up, is being able to be able to reuse that material, I would lean toward putting up some type of a structure, whether it's perfectly geometrical matching the plants or whether it's, you know, giving yourself some room to work underneath it. That part is up to you.
Yeah, a little bit of work up front, but then, you know, you can use it again next year and the year after that. And
yeah, the cost of the frame and the extra work putting it up would probably get repaid by not having to replace that material every year.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Because it's going to be tough to do in a raspberry setting because they're pretty sticky plants.
Yes, they are. Scott Royce, our guest today. He's a UW Extension Crop, Soils, and Horticulture Agent from Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties. Our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mehler. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here with my guest, Scott Royce, UW Extension Crop, Soils, and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence County. So you can call in with your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And, Scott, we're going to go right back to the phones. Barbara in Madison's been waiting a bit. Barbara, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi. How can we help you, Barbara?
Hi. I'm not sure I have a valid question at this point, but what I've done is put a couple of my grandchildren visited. I have a couple of anthills, one big one that's lasted for a number of years in our tiny garden. And the thyme plant grew on top of the anthill, so I let it stay for a few years. My grandchildren came, and they decided I should get rid of them. So they bought something called Terrell ant stakes, which they put one in each of the two hills that I now have. And I'm wondering, it's borax, but borax is only 4% of the stuff, and it said the other ingredients are the rest of that percentage. And I don't know what the other ingredients are. So I'm wondering if that borax and that antrap will render my soil incapable of growing good vegetables.
Okay.
Well, the easy answer is that the active ingredient portion of that is not going to be a problem. The boric acid that is in there is not problematic for plants. In fact, boron is often a needed nutrient in the soil, especially in our sandier soils. The other question in my mind is if it's actually going to do what you want it to. That's a little bit iffier.
Yeah.
That's not exactly the perfect setting for that. Usually when we deal with ant management in a larger setting like that, we're talking about either fairly heavy-duty insecticidal applications or patient's tillage and a little bit of just allowing them to be what they are, where they are, because it's more about the soil types than anything else usually.
Yeah, I know Phil Pelletieri talks about with these giant anthills taking a rod.
Yep.
And right down the center as deep as you can go, because you need to get down to where the queen is. The queen is, and then you can pour some boiling water down
Yep, boiling water or, you know, the boric acid solutions or one of the valid insecticides that would work in a setting like that. But, yeah, the ant species that we have in the state of Wisconsin that forms those large mounds is actually the formic ant. Field ant is a more common name for it. But and a lot of people will erroneously call them fire ants because when they bite you, they have an acid in their saliva, so that, thus formic, and you kind of get a little bit of a sting effect, but they're not even remotely closely related to the true fire ants in the far south.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Thankfully. A listener wondered if diatomaceous earth would help getting rid of those giant ant mounds, and I don't think they would do much.
Not so much, yeah. The diatomaceous earth works fairly well against soft-bodied type things, you know, so it works well against slugs and snails and, you know, immature sawflies, you know, things like that. But the exoskeleton on ants is going to be pretty resilient to diatomaceous earth.
Christian in Houghton, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Christian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a Honeycrisp apple tree in my yard, and for 3 years now, I'm pretty sure I've had apple leaf skeletonizers attacking the leaves. They end up skeletonized very, very finely. The leaves end up curled up with webbing inside and droppings inside the webbing. How do I get rid of them without having to use some kind of pesticide? Because I'd rather keep the apples organic if I can.
Okay, well, if you're in a fruit tree situation when you're dealing with the leaf rollers or the skeletonizers, the different species but same kind of effect, same kind of damage patterns usually. The unfortunate side of it is that there aren't too many options except insecticidal options unless you're willing to do physical control of them, because when they do the way they do their feeding, they're relatively protected. So they're not able to get hit by too many of the parasites or predators that we can have in a good, normal, healthy, you know, non-insecticidally treated home orchard. You can try insecticidal soap solutions. You can try water sprays if the populations aren't too high. You can probably get rid of a decent chunk of them. But if you have a pretty high level of infestation, you may either have to spend more time, literally, on doing physical control. But that's timing is very critical, obviously, or utilizing a post-bloom insecticidal application. Usually we don't see such significant damage that they are causing major production problems, but if you are in a spot where you get consistent and fairly high populations of them, you may have to do a little bit more work on figuring out for sure where what makes the most sense for your situation. Because there are 3, 4, 5 different species that could actually do this, to find their weak point, you might want to make certain that you're dealing with the right species. So up in your area, I know there's a couple of a fairly good extension and master gardener personnel in the Houghton area. So if you can get a sample into your local MSU extension office and or across the border into Wisconsin if you want, whichever, and then make sure that you're dealing with the right species, because that does change the control options a little bit.
All right, there we go. As long as you're mentioning agents, tell us some things UW Extension horticulture agents do to help people in the counties they cover.
Well, you're getting a little bit of a flavor for it now.
We
deal with a little bit of everything. Most of us in the county offices do a combination of problem solving, such as the type of thing we're doing here live today, as well as proactive programming where we're helping people make management decisions that are right for their operations by giving them the information that they need to do that decision making. And every each one of us has our own little niche that we probably spend more time on. Most people that know me call me a pest, period, but I tend to do more pest management stuff rather than plant selection work. But I can certainly, you know, everybody else in the state that works on horticulture issues has their own topics that are kind of their primary ballpark. One minor correction I should add, just for officiality, to the from the introduction, is that due to a combination of factors that I definitely won't go into, but mostly related to budget, my appointment in Florence County is no longer there. So I only serve officially in Marinette and O'Connell counties now. Although obviously, just like I think everybody else in the extension system across the entire nation, we help anybody who calls or contacts us. So that's not a problem.
Well, how difficult is it working with two or three counties?
Well, it just spreads out the workload. It's, you know, one of the goals of Extension is to meet the educational needs of the citizens of the state of Wisconsin where they work, where they live, and in some cases where they play, I suppose. Covering a wider geographical area just gives you more opportunities to get out and about and to do educational sessions and workshops and field days in more areas. It spreads it out over more soil types from, in my case, you know, mostly sandy soils, but we also have some areas in southern O'Connell County. We had one caller from Swamico, which is, she's probably actually in Brown County, but right on the edge. So where we have some heavier, more poorly drained soils. So, you know, we cover a wider area when we do that, which just means we have more pests to deal with, more species, more everything else.
Yeah. And in terms of contacting a person's extension agent, what's the easiest way to do that?
Well, there is a county extension office in every county in the state of Wisconsin. So finding where that is, you know, that varies by the county. Most of the time they're in some type of either the main county government center or an associated building. Certainly, if you're web adept at all, go on to any search engine and just type in your county UW extension, and you're going to get right to their web book or their web page or their Facebook page or wherever, and then you can contact through there. I mentioned digital images before. For those of us who work particularly in the plant side of life in agriculture and horticulture, it's a whole lot easier to identify something when we have a photo in front of us rather than trying to describe it over the phone or over the radio waves.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Well, Maxine in Marinette has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Maxine.
Hi. I have a problem with some arborvitae. They were just beautiful, and over 5 years old, one is 10 years old. Just over the last, early spring in the last couple of months, totally turned brown. And the one right next to it is, three of them next to it are just fine. So what would cause that?
Well, unfortunately, we are dealing with this across the entire, at least the northern portion of northeastern Wisconsin. It's a pretty wide area where we had some very severe winter injury across woody perennials, both trees and shrubs, as well as herbaceous perennials. And arborvitae are one of the poster children for the winter injury of this last year. I've literally probably had no less than 24 inquiries just on arborvitae damage from this winter alone, just from Marinette and O'Connell counties. The combination of winter conditions that we had with the fall that we had as far as setting plants up for some damage, a really sharp transition from warm soil to cold soil, at least in northeast Wisconsin, some barren times where we didn't have snow cover, potentially, at least depending on precisely where you are, led to some drought inducement, I guess is the best way to say it, where we have frozen soil and those conifers need moisture all winter long. So when the soil freezes, then they can't get enough moisture. And because we were wet going into the winter, the soil froze a little bit more quickly and more more hard, if that makes sense to people. So we did have some of that. And then the spring wasn't all that great for our plants either, especially that blizzard that we got toward the end of April, I think was kind of the final death knell for some plants. The really unfortunate thing with species like arborvitae, they don't recover from damage like this very well. They're very slow growing, and at least in the standpoint of recovery. They do not have many latent buds within their canopy. It's better than rhododendron or something like that, which really has none, and we had rhododendron issues as well. But if you have an entire tree that is brown, the blunt answer is that it probably has zero chance of recovery at this point. Now, you can leave it for a couple more weeks and maybe we'll get a positive surprise. But realistically, it's probably done. For those of you who are dealing with specimens that have maybe one branch that died back, you can properly prune that branch out and eventually it will fill back in. The smaller the branch, obviously, the quicker it will fill back in. But with something that is as slow recovering as arborvitae, it's going to take a couple of years before it looks as good as it did prior, if it does completely recover.
There you go, Maxine. Thank you for calling. Louisa in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Louisa.
Hi there. Okay, I have about 150 different hostas. I love hostas, and the slugs love hostas. Are you there?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, okay, all right. And I've used diatomaceous earth and I've used sluggo, but that gets to be really expensive. I went online, and this was recommended by people, not necessarily by an agency or, whatever. And they were saying one part ammonia to 10 parts water and then spray that on the plants. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm thinking, I'm searching my brainwaves and not coming up with a real, either anything exceptionally witty to say here or highly
pertinent.
As far as legality, ammonia is right on the edge. Depending on the product itself, it probably is considered legal. Ammonia can have some effects on slugs and snails because of what it would do to their internal biology. The problem running through my head is that I can also see some problems for the hostas themselves. So if you're going to try something like that, number one, double check it because I don't have access to all of my information here. Double check and make sure that it's not going to cause problems for the hostas first. So call your Minnesota Extension Service. I know especially in the Winona area, there's a couple of really strong horticulture agents in that area. They'll know real fast too, or be able to double check it for you because that's one I haven't had before. I do get concerned when we start looking at alternative options like this. Some of them work great. Some of the ones I get questions about, and we talked about earlier about insecticidal soap as far as homemade solutions, they're actually illegal. Now, with landscape plants, obviously, we have a little bit more flexibility. But when we're dealing with food plants, whether it's herbs, and that's why I was really hesitant about that ant question before because there was a herb involved. But herbs, fruits, vegetables, if you use something that's illegal and that's a perennial plant, from the perfectly legal wording, you can never eat material that comes off of that plant ever again. So you have to be really careful when you're dealing with those types of non-labeled opportunities.
Yep, there we go. Thanks, Louisa. Appreciate the call. Laura in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Laura.
Hi there. I appreciate your program. I'm a new member to the area, and your program is an audible Bible for me. I have a rhododendron or azalea tree. It's about 5 feet tall. It's against the north wall of my house, a stone house, and it is shaded by a cedar. And the leaves have all gone except for a few around the brown buds, which are curled. The leaves are curled. And I thought it might be a lack of circulation, a fungus, so I cleared out some vellum seal around them. and some other things and sprayed them with vinegar, but I have no idea what I'm doing.
Hmm.
Okay. Until that last statement, I was in connection with you here. But anyway, assuming that this problem just cropped up in the last month or two here, is that what you described is perfect for the winter injury that we've experienced in rhododendrons and some azaleas, but mostly rhododendrons across this area of the state of Wisconsin. I've gotten photos, I've seen samples myself, and lost one in my own garden, as for that matter, of rhododendrons that just literally could not make it through the winter because of the combination of conditions that I kind of went through earlier here. Vinegar is a pretty good herbicide, so spraying vinegar onto plants is an effective way to kill them. So never apply vinegar in any way, shape, or form to plants that you actually like. Now, if you're trying to get rid of them, vinegar is an option. And actually, in the asparagus weed management we talked about before, it is an organic option. But make sure that you actually use one of the herbicidal vinegars if that's your goal, too, because they are labeled for that use and they're the right concentrations. Unfortunately, with rhododendrons, because they do not have any latent buds on their branches, if the upper portion of the plants died and the stuff that maybe was below the snow line or something survived, the only thing you have for opportunities to try to revive a rhododendron is to cut all the dead material off and try to let them regrow or reposition them so that they get back their form. But quite honestly, our woody plant specialist, Laura Joel, her recommendation is pull them out and start over. Because they may take decades to recover, and they may literally never look. And her response was specific to a larger plant, but for a smaller plant that is there, you'd have a little bit more opportunity for it to recover and look the way you want. But if you had a really large one, like I had one sample come in to me, or one photo, but where the plant was pushing 8 feet in diameter, 5 feet high, and everything from about 8 inches above the ground up was dead.
Oh.
And that plant had, I mean, it was not completely dead, obviously. That bottom portion was alive, but it would have taken decades for it to look the way that it did if it ever was able to recapture that.
Oh, too bad. Laura, thank you very much for calling. Tom in Appleton, have you got something quick for us?
Yeah, thanks, Larry. The fellow that called in wondering about what weeds are going to be a problem in a prairie planting, if he's working in a heavier soil area, I can quickly say that reed canary grass, Canada thistle, and then second tier, probably sweet clover, probably various things like crown vetch, bird's foot trefoil, but I'm going to stop there so as not to overwhelm. Learn what reed canary grass is, learn what Canada thistle is, and you'll be 50% of the way to vanquishing the worst weeds that are impacting your prairie planting.
Oh.
I don't call them prairies because where I live and work, there were no prairies. They're nice plantings, but we had a different thing here called a forest. That's all I had, Larry. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, probably a pretty good tip there to sort of end our programs. Scott, I tell you what, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're just coming off a few days of vacation, and I appreciate you stepping
training.
In.
Training, yeah. Not vacation. I was down in training. Kentucky. Actually, the training I was undergoing, there were five of us from Wisconsin Extension down there. We were getting trained on the Food Safety Modernization Act and how to help producers meet the requirements of that particular act.
Man, you do a little of everything. Hey, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it very much.
Yep, glad to be here.
Scott Royce, our guest, UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. And we'll get him back and we will do this again. Coming on Monday, we'll talk about energy with our guest from the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And then we'll learn about finding and cooking with wild mushrooms. A great new book on it. So I hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.